Hi, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 25th, the year 2002, and today happens to be Jubilee Day in Holden Village. Now let's join Wanda Diefeldt with her session entitled Women's Way of Reading the Bible in Brazil. This is tape number DEW 2002-08. And now let's join Wanda and the people.
They can join the conversation. Welcome. Would you like to sit like closer in a very cozy atmosphere here as we are?
Yeah, right.
I think those front pews are only for visitors.
Oh, right? You know, there's one thing that I like about this place is that in the village center, the comfortable benches are in the front, you know.
Yeah.
I think it should be like that in my home church as well, you know. It's like get people closer to the pew, from the pew closer to the altar.
Does anyone know what time Vespers
is? 6:30.
So you have until 6:15. Yeah. Sorry to miss your session. That's very interesting.
I know, I wanted to be both.
Yeah. I know.
Prisons? Prison reform?
Yeah. So, well, I think we will start. We can start taping too. Thank you. My name is Wanda Diefeldt, and I'm from Brazil. I'm a Lutheran pastor, and I teach at the Lutheran Seminary in the city of São Leopoldo, which is in the metropolitan area of Porto Alegre, in the southernmost part of my country. And our subject today is women's ways of reading the Bible. And since today we are celebrating the Jubilee, I thought it would be appropriate for us to think how women have been reading the Bible in light of the Jubilee. If you have been following any of the activities at Holden this day, you probably know from the Bible study this morning to all the discussions that we have had during the day, that Jubilee was actually a worldwide initiative in the year 2000 geared toward forgiveness of debt, especially related to the International Monetary Fund, related to World Bank, and the fact that the gross national product, the GNP of most of the countries in the world, is nowadays consumed by paying international debt. Brazil among other countries did not qualify for this international movement because it was applied that debts were forgiven only to those countries that were extremely poor. And Brazil, being a rich country, but with a lot of poor people, did not qualify for that. So the discussion that we had in Brazil all around the year 2000 and onwards was related to the notion of Jubilee. And especially it was also dealt in the women's groups, in the Bible study groups that we have had in Brazil. And because the notion of the Jubilee, even though it was very much focused on the issue of forgiveness of debt, it was worked especially by our grassroots Bible study groups, which I bring to you also one sample of, you know, a summary of what we have been doing also in terms of women reading the Bible. There's a special issue about Jubilee and women's bodies, which I find fascinating, related to other dimensions of the Jubilee. And this is something that they wrote on the board this morning, which I wanted to draw your attention to. Today we have discussed very much about the economic dimension of the Jubilee, meaning to say debts are forgiven. And that goes back to the Leviticus in the Old Testament, where in fact every 7 years debts were forgiven and there was a restitution. And the forgiveness of debts meant also, which is how we also celebrate the Sabbath, that that's the seventh day, or this is the seventh year, or it's every 70 years, which is related to the notion of Shabbat, means Saturday, right? That's the day of rest. And that means also that the land needs to rest for a whole year. Of course, in those times, in biblical times, both as it is described in the Hebrew and in the Greek Bible, the land, people did not make use in such an intensive way of the land, and that meant that every 7 years, in the seventh year, the land needed to be put to rest, because there was no agricultural knowledge about how to make use of the land without having it rest. And that's very interesting to work this notion of the Shabbat related to the ecological dimension. How do we let the earth rest as well? And then there's a third dimension, which is freedom and reconciliation. You know that in biblical times, families that were indebted sold their own children into slavery, but they knew that by 7 years that would no longer be true, because people should be returned. Of course, it needs to be also pointed out, even though this seems quite humanitarian, that this did not apply to foreigners, and that's why among the Israelites they had slaves from other ethnic racial groups. For instance, if you read in the Bible about Ethiopian slaves, for instance, or that Hagar was an Egyptian a slave to Sarah, that did not apply to other ethnic and racial groups. So, but it did work within the Israelite group. And then fourth has to do with the freedom then of the slaves, and the freedom also of restituting the well-being of the body. And the way that these dimensions are worked into these the texts here have to do primarily with the reality of women in Brazil, and what does the Jubilee mean for women? What does the Jubilee mean for women? And especially women at the grassroots, women, you know, in everyday walks of life. We are not talking only about women who are the high executives who are entitled, or who are college, university professors who then are entitled to sabbaticals for further research and things like that. We're talking about what would this concept mean for women? I mean, like, very common, simple, you know, your neighbor type of woman. And in some of one of the things that this project developed, this reading of the biblical text from a women's perspective then in Brazil, made available a series of research done in different corners of Brazil. Then one from northeast Brazil, for instance, they wanted to know how did women perceive themselves in relation to Jubilee. So they explained the notion of Jubilee, as I have as well. And they found out that women were facing many difficult situations. And among them, they felt domestic violence as being a very poignant situation, something that was really being completely ignored by the traditional church. Many women who would come to talk to a priest or talk to a pastor, especially the Pentecostal pastors, they would hear from the pastor, well, this husband who is an alcoholic and who beats you, he is the cross that you need to bury. And so if you want to attain salvation, you need to suffer in the here and now, and then you will have a very good place in heaven. Well, if they were to remain in these abusive relationships, of course they would get quite quickly to that heaven, because many of the women were actually beaten to death. And that was becoming such a, you know, situation that was unbearable to the women, especially in the Northeast Brazil, and those who were doing this, collecting life stories and wanting and interviewing women, and they said, well, this is something that we need to be paying attention. And they found out that, in doing further research, that every 15 seconds, one woman is beaten in Brazil. So every 15 seconds, one woman is beaten in Brazil. And if you know our machista culture, if you know how, you know, macho men our Latin Americans want to portray themselves, even when brought to court, and even if facing female judges, some of the men who were brought to court had the dare to ask, well, she is my wife, I'm entitled to beating her, because I need to correct her in whatever she's doing. So it's the same understanding applied then to children that is applied to women, you know, and the only way to discipline is by the use of violence, which is something that you can see repeats itself in a chain of violence, you know, that husband beats a wife, a wife, the mother beats the children beat the dog, and so it goes. And so they found that quite striking. The second thing that they found also in their research, and just talking to women, was how overwhelmed women were actually by the amount of work they had to do every day. You'd be surprised in knowing that many, many of the women, especially those that work in the sugarcane plantations or in the coffee crops, and those who work as seasonal workers, they get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to go on top of the truck, and then they are hauled to pick coffee beans and to cut the sugar cane, and that's part of their livelihood. So they work the whole day, they receive less than men do for the work. It's an average of 50% what the men do receive for the same type of work, because the large landowner will say, well, a woman does not cut as much sugar cane as a man, so I will pay her only half because she does not have as much physical strength. Well, I have seen these sugar cane plantations, I've seen the coffee crops, and I've seen the cocoa plantations in Brazil, and or the tobacco plantations, and I'll tell you, but the amount of work that the women put into it, is as much as any man does as well. So it's exhausting physical work. And I was talking yesterday to Lauren about this. It's interesting how the Brazilian economy has always given priority to what is called this cash crops that are exported for the after dinner economy. It's like nothing that is staple, it's everything that you have after dinner. You have coffee, you have chocolate, you have your cigar, and of course you have your rum to go with it, but that's not part of the staple. That's the way it is, it's not. So the women were overwhelmed.
Where are you supposed the source of the machista culture come from? Is that indigenous, or did that come from Europe?
It comes. It's a mixture, but I would say that largely it comes from an European concept of the colonizers themselves. When the first Portuguese and Spanish came to Brazil, Brazil was discovered by Pedro Álvares Cabral, and you know that Christopher Columbus discovered the Americas. And in that culture, there was a very strong component of a very androcentric, patriarchal culture that was there. And I think that was part of the culture. But then another aspect needs to be pointed out, which is that of colonialism itself. And our books, in our history books, tend to be very romantic about how colonialism happened 500 years ago. And if you are a feminist, if you are a woman, you start reading history also from a different standpoint. Come to think about, you know, the do you think all these native women were actually, you know, jumping on the beaches and say, hey, you, come, let's do something fun together? Oh, I don't think so. Do you think that was the fact of the same with the African female slaves? I don't think so. And I think that's it's a history of rape, of sexual abuse and exploitation. In talking to an Afro-American woman who has a light skin, she told me that for many years it was a reason of embarrassment for her, a reason for shame that she had the color, the light color that she had, because it was written on her skin that her foremothers had not been able to defend themselves from sexual assault. And so you see how women's bodies carry this. And I think in the case of Brazilian women, because we are the result of the mixing of indigenous, of African, of Portuguese, of immigrant blood, that is written in our bodies as well. And the women reported in this research that 98%, and that was confirmed by research done by a foundation called Perseu Abreu, 98% of the work done inside the home was done by women. 98% of the domestic labor was carried out by women. So you imagine, a woman has a whole day, you know, cutting sugar cane, picking beans, working in an office, a teacher, and still she comes home, she is the sole responsible for cleaning, cooking, washing, taking care of kids, putting kids to bed. Everything inside the home is women's responsibility. So this is the second dimension. One was domestic violence, one is the exploitation of female labor. And then the third aspect, which this research has pointed out, is how the religious component of our culture tends to blame women. Women have a sense of guilt that is perpetual. And that comes from a long-standing tradition since the beginning of Christianity, so to say, in which women have been identified since the passage of 1 Timothy chapter 3, verses 11 to 15, that you know very well. It says, if I can read it to you, to show to you why women do have that that sense of guilt. It says, I'm reading from chapter 3, Timothy, 1 Timothy, verses 11 to 15. It says, the women likewise must be serious, no slanderers, but temperate, faithful in all things. Let deacons be the husband of one wife, and let them manage their children and their households well. And then it goes on to say...
Well, see, it says that they're supposed to manage the household.
Yeah. And then it goes on to say... Oh, sorry, I'm reading the wrong chapter here. 2:11 to 15. Let the woman learn in silence with all submissiveness. Okay? Let the woman learn in silence with all submissiveness. I permit no woman to teach or to have authority over man. She is to keep silent. For Adam was formed first, then Eve. And Adam was not deceived, but the woman was deceived and became a transgressor. Yet woman will be saved through bearing children if she continues in faith and love and holiness with modesty. That's a type of teaching that started already at the end of the first century and carried itself onwards ever since, in which women were to feel shameful and guilty because all women are descendants of Eve. And our Eve-ness means, well, we are worth less than them because we were second in the order of creation. But as the author says, women, or first Eve and then all women, we were the first ones to transgress. And that is something that has been carried. You would be surprised, and I think in a Protestant setting that characterizes the United States, this is not as strong, but in Latin America, that machista culture associated with this type of teaching, which repeated generation after generation that women are second in the order of creation, you say second class citizens. We're the first ones to sin, meaning to say women are much more prone to any sort of sexual misbehavior, any type of temptation. And how that is carried even nowadays. I was surprised the other day when my daughter came to me and she said, Mom, did you know that woman was created after man were? I said, where is it written? And said, here. And then she opened the Bible and she came directly to the second chapter of Genesis. And she has a children's Bible. And I said, but what makes you say that? Do you think there is something behind it? Yeah, if somebody is created first, means to say they are more important. She's 9 years old. Mm-hmm. Certainly she never heard this at home. but somehow she picked it up. It's like in the air. This is part of our culture, that women are worth less than men. And I said to her, well, let's go to Genesis 1, 26, 27. And you will see that God created man and woman, that both are created in the image of God. And she said, yes, Mom, but you see, here it's like an introduction, and then the story is the one that follows. And I said, okay. so I was forced to take out my Hebrew Bible and show to her and prove that when it said in the Genesis 2 passage, when it mentioned man, it was not male human being. It was not a human being of the masculine sex, that it meant Adam. And I had to show, I mean, this is a 9 year old, and she wanted to understand, okay, here is written Adam in Hebrew letters, Adam. So see here, it's written Adam. And then when woman is created, then it's called Ish, which is male. And then it's called Isha, that is female, you see? So that it's not that man was created first. It is that a human being, humanity, doesn't make explicit what the sex of Adam was. It simply means somebody who is made out of the earth, from clay. And then when God creates woman is when man passes into existence. And so she said, well, Mom, only you know about this because you know Hebrew, but you know, none of my colleagues know Hebrew. Imagine, 9 years. None of my colleagues know Hebrew, so I guess I will just have to take your word. I said, yeah, well, you can take my word. I mean, you can see it. But it's so strong in the culture that women are created second, and that not only makes the importance of rereading biblical text and saying, even in a passage like the one of Genesis 2, where woman is created to be a helpmate, many women see, well, I was created to be a helpmate, like to be like an auxiliary to my husband. And you need to go back to the Hebrew and say, well, a helpmate, an auxiliary, the word in Hebrew means ezer, is somebody who is in the same level as man. It is not somebody who is like a rug that you can step on, or it's somebody who is inferior, somebody that you can simply use as your slave. That's not what it is said there, which in our Latin American setting, most of the priests and pastors, when they use this in their homilies for weddings, they say, well, you see, and you were created to be his helpmate. Mm-hmm. So you are here to serve him. You are here to obey him. And I find that so important to go back and see, well, you know how many times the word Ezer is used in the Old Testament? It is, in the majority of the times, it's used to describe the relationship between God and humanity. God is Ezer. God is a helper of humanity. And so when humanity wants to intercede and talk to God, then they say, God, you are our Ezer, which is the same wording that is described for this first woman. So she's not somebody who is inferior. She is somebody who is there in the capacity. She is empowered to be able to be a true companion to him. And I find it fascinating to discuss, you know, Hebrew terminology with women who do not even know how to read and write. And they are fascinated and said, oh, so that is what it means. You know, we never thought about that. And even for those who know how to read it, they say, well, you see, how badly translated these Bibles really are. And say, yes, you're right. Everything is really poorly translated. So maybe we have to reinterpret things ourselves. But when it comes to the notion of guilt, it's fascinating to study, and a lot of research has been done in this area, especially among Roman Catholic women, the notion of guilt that women have. Women carry this sense of not being fit for things, of not being capable to do things. That they, even the position that they take in society, they are not worthy for that. It's such a low self-esteem added to this sense of guilt, which I think that Christianity, and not even the Protestant churches like our own, have been capable of getting rid of. And I think it has to do with the historically and the culturally conditionings that we are set ourselves. And it has to do also with the issue of sexuality. You know that the teaching, especially of the Roman Catholic Church towards women, is one that binds women to the reproductive role. Women have to be, and the text here in 1 Timothy 2, 11 to 15 says it as well, that women will only be saved through motherhood. Meaning to say that's the only role that women are supposed to have. And then, well, we are always famous, Brazilians are always famous for, you know, being very loose with our body, that we are quite free, that we are joyous, happy people. And you ask women, well, and how does that apply to your sexual life? And the majority of the women will say, well, whenever I have sexual intercourse, even with my husband, I have a sense of guilt because I can only have sex if it is to procreate. That's what the church teaches. And many women will say, well, I have an image of Jesus on a cross in my bedroom, and when I know that I'm going to have sex with my husband, I just put a piece of cloth on my head. I don't want to have Jesus, you know, peeking at what I'm doing because it's something so ugly. It's something, you know, that's not appropriate. And come to think about where does this idea come from? If it's not from this very bound culture that is so repressive, and that how important it is to get rid of this sense of guilt for women. So the Jubilee, if we had to celebrate the Jubilee in Brazil today, we would have done it quite differently. first of all, nobody would have had to do any scrubbing of walls and picking weeds and things like that, because the Jubilees also a day to rest your body. We would have proposed massage for everybody. It's like take it easy for one day. It's like, no schedules. Because that's also what Jubilee means. Like, be good to yourself. Be good to your body. Your body deserves it. You do not have to punish it. And the respect for the integrity of the body, of the goodness of God's creation, is part of the Jubilee as well. And that is what women discovered in studying the Jubilee. And all the texts of Leviticus were completely reinterpreted in light of the well-being of human bodies, and especially the well-being of women's bodies. And then looking for biblical texts that would also empower women in making a difference in whatever they were doing. And so, for instance, in relationship to domestic violence, in denouncing texts like those in Judges 19 that talks about a woman who is so brutally abused and then her body is sent to the 12 tribes to show what had been done to a property, because she was a property of a Levite. In pointing out the acceptance that Jesus had toward women in affirming women's dignity, women's well-being. And it's very fascinating how some biblical passages, like the one of Jesus and the adulterous woman, is saying, you see, there is no condemnation. So if Jesus would not condemn a woman who had been in a relationship outside of her wedding, so much less the relationship that we have inside our own wedding. Where is it written that having pleasure with one's body, with one's partner, sexual delight is sinful? This is something, it was picked somewhere else. And I think recovering that. And all the rereading that was done, especially with the book Song of Solomon, was really very helpful to show, well, this is in the Bible. This is not some porn movie that you rented, you know. This is in the Bible. This is a holy book. So if it is in the holy book, why shouldn't you think about a relationship with yourself, your well-being, with a partner, and see that as part of the good creation that God has made. And so, also the issue of domestic work, it was quite fascinating to see women rediscover the biblical passages related to Martha and Mary, and say, sometimes it's okay to be Martha, but it's good to be Mary too, and just sit at Jesus' feet and learn, because the position that Martha and Mary, it's always presented to us as two conflicting positions, one that is very active and the one that is, you know, kind of lazy and just wants to listen to Jesus. And yet the two women represent very important facets of women's lives, and how most women will in fact be Marthas. I find that there are very few women who feel comfortable sitting and studying and learning while something else is going on. Most women will be immediately, you know, like, yeah, we have to be doing this. And the passages are so empowering to women, because when Mary sits at Jesus' feet, not only does Jesus accept the fact that she is one of his disciples. Because when Jesus was, at Jesus' time, the way masters taught disciples was not in classrooms. People did not have chairs to sit. And so a master, a professor, a teacher, would have a little bench, maybe a little bit higher than this, and sit on the bench, and the disciples would sit at the master's feet. And so when the pastor says, Mary was sitting at Jesus' feet and then he started teaching and talking to her, meaning to say she was being a disciple, she was learning. And how when women discovered, wow, we never knew that women could actually be followers in such a close way, because we always learned from the Bible that Jesus only had 12 male disciples, and those 12, you know, were the ideal for discipleship, and that no woman was allowed to follow. Well, in reading the Bible with women in Brazil, first we make use of this hermeneutics of suspicion and say, well, you know, yeah, there were 12 male disciples, but do you think these were actually the best role models the church could have? See, one betrayed Jesus, denied him 3 times. One sold him for a handful of coins. Wow, way to go, church, you know? It's like, and yet the women who are around Jesus, they are very faithful, very committed. They see in Jesus a new alternative. Mm-hmm. And if it is true that Jesus had a group of 12 disciples, there is a group that is even closer than the disciples, which is the circle of friends. And the women are part of the circle of friends. Martha, Mary, Mary Magdalene, Lazarus. This was a closer group than those of the disciples, which I find quite interesting to see how did women relate to all these people. And then in the Gospel of John, there's the beloved disciple who is, you know, closer to Jesus himself. And I find all of these rereadings, they do have a very important component in bringing about, first of all, a challenge to the women themselves. Because at the moment that you can identify the religious, the biblical underpinning for a whole theological, cultural construction of machismo, if you can just take that one little brick, you know, that is sustaining it all, you take away that authority, hopefully you will have the whole thing tumbling down. And I think challenging, you know, making the critical questions, you know, the why questions, why things are the way they are. And I think secondly, that also has a capacity of empowering women in reading biblical texts, even if they do not know how to read and write it in the Bible. You know, I stumble over English when I need to read it, because it's not my first language, but can you imagine how difficult it is for women who do not know how to read and write? So exercising a whole different methodology of appropriating biblical texts, you know. You read a text very slow because many people don't know how to read and write. So they only rely on listening, and they have developed listening, but you have to listen, you have to talk slowly. So you cannot rush because people will not have a text in front of them to check later. And then have people tell the story in their own voices. Say, now what have you heard? Let us tell the story again, and people will tell the details. The things that they leave out is because they were not important, so then there is a screening. But those that the people themselves repeat, these are the points that are important, you know. And based on those aspects that come back in the telling as we have heard it, you can identify also what is important in people's lives. And it's fascinating for me, in especially in the women's groups, in seeing how aspects of everyday life are so important. They will say aspects like feeding, cooking, water, land, things that have to do with everyday sustenance. So instead of talking about the big theological questions, the women, especially in the grassroots, they will be very concerned with the livelihood. So take the passage of John 4, where Jesus discusses with the Samaritan woman. And most people, the theologians especially, they never come in their commentaries, they hardly ever come to the end of the chapter, because they dwell so much on this, I'm the one, the living water, and what does that all mean, and then the difference between the Samaritans and the Jews. And women come directly to the point, they say, hey, there's this woman, she had five husbands. You know, I had three husbands. And he doesn't seem to condemn her. Although the priest or the pastor, when they read the text in the Bible, they say, because five husbands you have had. They read it like that. But when I read it with them, I will read it in a different tone and say, oh, this is interesting, because I always thought that Jesus was pointing a finger. You didn't say anything about Jesus pointing a finger at her. Well, it's not written in the text, so you don't need to point a finger. But in the readings that you do from the pulpit, that's usually how it is read, because five husbands you have had. And they say, I have had three husbands, I have four husbands, it's very common, especially in the urban setting in Brazil, that women have had more than one husband. And they say, Jesus doesn't condemn her. That's interesting. And look, this is the only place in the Bible where Jesus reveals himself as Messiah, because in the other passages he asks, who do you say I am? And then he says, well, you are the Son of God, the one should come. And Martha is the one in John 11, 27, because she also has a confession similar to Peter that we have long forgotten. It's a beautiful confession. But she's the one who says, yeah, you are the Son of God, the one who came to save us all. But in this passage, it's the only place where Jesus himself reveals who he is. He reveals his identity to this woman of questionable reputation. Come to think about it, he talks a lot of theology. I have not remembered any other text in which he talks so much about theology as in this passage. To a woman who is not even a Jew, a woman who, you know, everybody was talking about in her village. And at the end of the passage, one woman pointed out to me the other day, as we were studying this, she said, look how interesting, he enjoyed this conversation so much that the woman goes back and he never drank the water. Because the story begins, Jesus asks, give me some water. And then she says, you know, but you know what you're asking? You are a Jew and a Samaritan. You don't even have a cup. And then this long dialogue goes on. And this, I think Jesus was enjoying himself so much that he forgot about the water he wanted to drink. So the woman goes away. And these are the small things that women perceive in readings. Like, yeah, look at this. And I think it's very empowering because the biblical texts are not judgmental. They do not come pointing a finger to women, to poor people, as the majority of Christianity has done, unfortunately, in our country. It's very moralistic, even though its morality it follows double standards. You know, one thing is allowed to the man, to the rich, to the large landowners, and something else is required of the poor, especially women and children. And I think these contradictions are pointed out. It's like, yeah, but the Bible doesn't say that. It says something different. It has a new possibility and the capacity of empowering women also in their daily lives, I think, is very important. One thing, when I pointed out in the case of the Samaritan woman that in this group several women had been married more than once, I saw several of you raising your eyebrows. And there's one thing that I should explain about Latin American cultures, especially grassroots, mean to say people from low income. There's a sociologist called Otto Maduro from Venezuela, and he has pointed out how the religious implication of the morality of people has never really cut across to the popular sectors, even though Christianity meant to be quite moralistic about marriages and things like that, especially in Roman Catholicism, that never actually came through because the economic necessities were different. And then there's another anthropologist. He has also very interesting study in the concept of family. In interviewing men and women from the low-income classes, he was quite surprised in identifying that when women were talking about families, they were talking about themselves and their children. Themselves as women and children. This was their notion of family. And when men were describing their family, they were always talking about their relationship to their mother. So the comprehension of family is completely different, because the idea that we have of a nuclear family that's portrayed in the media and that also in your country has been widely challenged, especially in the past decades, that has never been true for a low-income families. Because, you see, the culture is quite matrilinear. The mother is the center of everything. So the men are the passers-by. I mean, they their relationship, they will stay for 6 months or years, but they will move on, because there is no no responsibility, there is no sense of commitment of family. This is a middle class value. And that's why a man will always refer to family as his mom. So the worst thing that you can ever do in any Latin American country, take it from me, is to offend somebody's mom. I mean, you might get killed for doing that, because it's like mothers are holy, mothers are saints. So it's like you should never offend somebody's mom, because this is fundamental to the notion of family, because that's where you're where you come from. And women will always tend to gear towards their children, because that is where their safety comes from. And so even in her old age, the children will take care of her. So moms will be taken care of. So just to explain a little bit about the influence. And so of course the women love reading stories about Mary in the Bible, because she is the hero. And all the moms are always highly valued in biblical texts, because that's the foundation of it all. It's by all the credit that you get from your children. And sometimes they don't understand why there's such a big fuss about all the patriarchs, you know, because apparently they don't, you know, they are not there, you know, to like, at least in the Latin American country. So any comments that you would like to make or questions, jump in.
Talk a lot. What do they do with the text when Jesus' mother and brothers are coming to get him? You know, he says, "Who is my mother and brother?" And he looks around to those, and I'm giving the backhand to his mom.
Yeah. Now you have to understand something also, which is quite an ecumenical challenge. You know that in our countries, Roman Catholicism is the religion of the majority of the people. And in Roman Catholicism, because of all the dogmas related to Mary, one of them, the Immaculate Conception, means that Mary never had any other sexual intercourse, and therefore she did not bear any other children. And so they will not understand that as being Jesus' brothers to begin with, but they understand it always as being cousins. Okay, well, people are creative. People are very creative. But it has helped us also in pointing out how, in fact, families can also bind. And you would find it quite interesting to analyze how women feel oppressed by other women, and how liberating it is, you know, having such a word of Jesus saying, well, you know, who is my mother, who are my brothers? Because sometimes you have to break away from what the culture expects your motherly role to be, and therefore how freeing it is for you to say, well, I'm not bound to this pattern to this type of attitude. I do not have to follow it as it is. I can just be myself and break away. And that especially, I think it's a problematic relationships between mothers-in-law and daughters-in-law. That these are very, very complicated relationships in all over Latin America. You have huge soap opera plots, you know, on TV, dealing with, you know, how your mother-in-law is really this nasty woman who does all these horrible things because she will think that nobody and nothing is good enough for her son. And that is part of our culture, because a woman knows that her son will always take care of her. And if you need to choose, he will choose mom, you know. And so daughters-in-law are very careful when they deal with mothers-in-law. It's a very interesting dynamic, you know. Which does not happen to be my case. It's like I always say, well, it's God in heaven and my mother-in-law on earth, you know, it's different. And I think it's interesting for the women to be able to realize that it's not always necessary to have women compete against each other for a man, even if it is for a son or a husband. And in that sense, rereading some biblical texts like Hagar and Sarah, for instance, is also very liberating for women in trying to imagine, would this story between Hagar and Sarah have a different ending if the two of them had gotten together and challenged Abraham?
Yeah.
You know, it's like in the story as it is, he turns out to be the hero, but here's this great patriarch who does nothing in the whole plot. This is Genesis 16 and Genesis 21. And he does nothing. I mean, he just looks while this conflict is going on between these two women. And then when he sends Hagar off into the wilderness, he actually is good enough to give him still some water to take along. It's like, if these women had gotten together, would things have been different? And it's funny, creative, how the women themselves, they feel so free to imagine different endings to stories as well. And we do it with a lot of theater, poetry, music, because, as I said, they don't always have biblical texts in front of them. Sometimes in a meeting, only one person has a Bible. Sometimes only me, because I take my Bible with me. But it is very, very interesting how this is done. And the very, just to share an experience, there we had an ecumenical Bible study, because when I was working in a pastor in the Lutheran church, now I'm full-time teaching at the seminary, when we used to meet once a month with the Methodist, with the Roman Catholic, and with the Missouri Synod, besides the Lutheran churches. And there were two Roman Catholic churches. There was one Methodist, one Missouri Synod, and ourselves. And once a month we would meet in one of these churches, and whoever was hosting it was also preparing the Bible study. And how fascinating it was for us to see not only learning the biblical text together, but also what is the type of songs that they are singing in that church, you know? What type of prayer they were going to use, what type of poetry or symbols and things like that. So we would have a whole evening, you know, large group of us, just getting this ecumenical feedback and using a biblical text related to women, and the majority of the participants were women. There were a few men interested on the subject. But it was very powerful too in how we exercised that. And always with a lot of freedom, lots of creativity.
Seems like that's one of the joys, really, if not, well, let me back up a minute. Those are oral, you know, traditionally oral or originally oral stories. And so you're really going back in some ways to the early time of hearing it when you're not stuck in having the printed word in front of you. I think sometimes it can free you to use your imagination and creativity.
You know, I never thought about it, you know, in such a scientific matter of fact as you have just put it. But of course, mm-hmm. you know, the first text, they were told from one generation mm-hmm. to the next. Mm-hmm. And that is how we go back and how people do have the freedom. And mm-hmm. I imagine the same thing must have happened, you know, centuries ago when the Bible was in the process of being written down. It's like, yeah, some things are added and some things are excluded. Among the things that are added, in rereading the Genesis 3 story, which is the narrative about the fall, there was this group of women in the church that we were discussing about what is this fall and how does it happen or not happen and what is this tree. And then several women, because of this sense of guilt that the women have, well, they said, well, the fall is that Adam and Eve had sex before getting married. I said, oh. And then, of course, we have to read the text, you know? And there it says, at the end of chapter 2, there's a verse 23, it says, 23 till 25, focusing on 24. Therefore, a man leaves his father and his mother and cleaves to his wife, and they become one flesh. And the man and his wife were both naked, and they were not ashamed. Well, in the biblical language, to become one flesh, it's like in the biblical sense of knowing. Mm-hmm. You know what it is?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you know what it is. and then afterwards comes this whole fall story, you know, like, how they actually ate of this tree. And so I said, well, I think they were having sex before that. And she was like, oh, do you mean so? Yeah, I think it's written here, you know, if we can, you know, say something. But then I said, what do you think this fruit is? And then she said, well, they were both naked, so I think they actually were having sex. And I said, gosh, you know, these people are really obsessed. They said, no, what is it about the fruit? Oh, it's an apple tree. I said, apple tree? Wow. I didn't remember, you know, reading anything. Let's read the whole thing again. So we read everything again. And we didn't find any apple in here. So what are we going to do with this? There's no apple. And she said, you know what, Pastor? This is a problem, because in the Bible of my childhood, they had apple written in it. This is a new translation, so, you know, has nothing to do with me. But, you know, in the Bible of my childhood, there was an apple in there. So the freedom, I mean, we there's a lot of freedom in dealing with the Bible, and the same freedom, I think, when you have oral tradition, you can just tell stories and jokes and laugh and because you're not bound to the academic exegetical, you know, nitty-gritties. Oh yeah, you know, and this is what it means. I use that a lot, but only if I find it's important, you know. If it goes really out of its way, then I give some guidance, but only in those aspects that I find really helpful for people themselves. Yes.
What did you find after you worked with these women? Like, how long was this, a year or 2 years? What I'm wondering is, what were the, I hate to use the word repercussions, but I'm guessing that's what happened.
Yeah.
Because if women are empowered in a system mm-hmm. where they are not to be empowered or to be disempowered, and suddenly they're empowered by God, mm-hmm. what happened to these women?
Yeah. Well, different things, you know. Some of the groups will last maybe a year. Some of them will go up to 4 to 5 years. Mm-hmm. It really depends. So it depends on the setting. What I find the repercussion that it has, first of all, is to the personal life of the woman themselves. I mean, there is something, a change in mentality and consciousness raising, saying, well, I'm not just a piece of crap, you know, I'm worth something. And women themselves will not put up with violence anymore. And it's not easy. Yeah. It takes a lot of courage to take some of these decisions. But I think they're less bound to notions of scandal and, you know, I'll get divorced and, you know, middle class families are horrified with divorce and separation because, you know, now we have to separate all of our property and our, you know, whatever we have. If you have nothing, it means like, yeah. So you just, everyone goes their way. It's a different mind setting. Although I've never really proposed that. The second step is, and I think that's, once they become assured, if they are boosted in their self-esteem, they will want their husbands to come. And this is at the stage that we are at this point. It's like, yeah, it does have an impact on women, but the men don't come. They will not come. And so we have tried to work in different alternatives, like with couples in the church, you know? Especially with young people, with the youth, and trying to see, well, what are we going to do with the next generation? Because for them, they say, they always finish a session saying, oh, I wish my husband had been here.
But look at your 9-year-old girl.
Yeah.
Your daughter is already hearing this message, and I don't think it's from her girlfriends, although it could be. But
from both.
It's a message, that's in the classroom.
It's in the culture.
It starts
in the air.
When they're three.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's where we are working at this point. The fact that women do have that impetus to make changes, and then they feel self-confident. But yet, what we produce in a Bible study is not enough to have that, you know, trickle-down effect also in their family relations. Just by the fact that you heard something doesn't mean that your husband will change attitudes. And you know how language dynamics go, how communication dynamics go. There's a very easy way to put them down again. So it takes a lot. I mean, they say you have to say something good 7 times to overcome something bad said only once, you know, and I think that's a work of historical patience that we are exercising ourselves to. So in the groups, I do think that there is a lot of good coming out, and especially the networking that the women do themselves and saying, well, I've learned this, I'm going to bring friends to participate, I want to start a group in my own church and other similar initiatives. But our big, big challenge at this point is working with men. And that's what we are tackling.
Yeah. A quick question with that is, in the ELCA, and I don't know, I'm Missouri, how long have women been ordained?
73.
Okay, so we don't even have a generation of that yet. And from what I understand, I mean, even though it's on the books that women are ordained, we're still not treated as equals either. So, I mean, when you think, here it's been institutionalized and it's still not the compatibility.
Yeah. Yes, please.
And I'm struck by an interesting paradox, and I don't think our society is entirely without this too, but it's the paradox of the men honoring really first and foremost their mothers.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And their mother is obviously a woman. Mm-hmm. And yet somehow finding shifting that same kind of honor into any other woman seems to not work out. And also for the women, if they are in a position of honor as a mother, that doesn't seem to shift into their other relationships to the other men in their lives other than their son.
I think you just gave a very interesting, you know, idea to go back and work with men about the issue of mother and respecting the mother of their own children, you know, and using that. I think because the way the culture is built is you honor your mother, but your wife is your inferior.
Mm-hmm.
And then she'll be honored by her children.
Yeah.
And that's a different relationship. And of course the chain can be broken precisely in this perspective of honoring mothers. Okay, so if that's a value that is important enough to to rescue, then why not using precisely the idea that you're developing, saying, yes, but you know, she is the mother of your children. But you see, Engels already explained that men have serious doubt if actually she's the mother of your children, because a man can never be sure about that. So it's like, yeah. and in our culture, I think that it's like, yeah, I'm safe with my mother because I know she's the one.
But that's not only in your culture, that's almost in every culture.
Yeah, but the male, you make a parallel?
Honors their own mother more than their spouse usually.
Could you make a parallel with the culture that you are?
Well, certainly here. I mean, at least in the legal system, you know, the woman is primarily going to be the custodial parent, unless there's something very wrong with the woman. And, you know, otherwise it's just sort of a given that if the relationship parts, if it splits up, that the children stay with the mother.
Mm-hmm.
Not all the time, but that's the norm, and that's the way we consider it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's and again, that's a middle class culture, so you've got all this property and things like that. But in a sense, there it's almost, in some ways, we almost look at the children as part of the property settlement. But they also stay with the mother.
But you know, you just gave me a very good idea. You know, thank you. I'm going to pick up on that, and I'm going to say, well, I talked to this man in the United States, and he just said, you know, why don't you go? So you give me the authority.
Chinese culture is interesting too, that the father is very important. So the fathers stay in the Chinese culture. The wife is less. They have a son. When the son grows up, brings a wife into the family, the father loses all status, and the mother-in-law has the power.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. And it is, I mean, where the grandfather, in other words, and then when that son has a child, then it's even more empowering. But that father is very important, wife is second, until the son is born, brings in a wife, father loses, the mother-in-law is all power. All power.
Because the she's mother, the one,
the mother, meaning the mother
of
the son who brings the daughter. Mm-hmm. And then that daughter, now we're in the next generation, you have the son and the daughter-in-law. She has nothing. I mean, she's as low as you can go until she has a son and he brings a daughter. That father, her husband, is no good. Then she is elevated.
Mm-hmm.
And that's old China. Ha, ha, ha. I mean, it is still...
Yeah.
Hong Kong today.
But we need to add the tape recorder, our tape minister. Thank you. we can continue talking about this because the parallel with Brazil is very similar. What I have noticed, however, that with the Chinese system, with the emphasis that you want to have boys. Because the boys will assure your safety and well-being in your old age.
Right.
Meaning to say, Chinese nowadays, the only, besides India, the only place in the world where there are more baby boys than girls. And there's a whole generation now that in some parts of the country in which there are no girls.
Yep.
But that's not because of birth rate, is it?
It's because of abortions at 9 months,
okay.
As well as
right.
The daughters are left on
selective,
the street.
Selective,
and
selective.
We adopt them here in America.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. It's not quite that severe, but there are, I mean, basically it's in the economics of, at least historically in China, the males or the son is responsible for the economic well-being of parents. The female has nothing to do with the economic well-being. The daughter is responsible more for the emotional and the, you know, caring, for the act of caring. So, but you know, when push comes to shove, it's a bottom line situation. You know, it's one thing to sort of get served hot tea and be taken care of by your daughter, but it's another thing to starve with because you don't have enough money to eat.
Yeah.
And so it's been historically that's been the value for the male. It's an economic necessity, or has been historically.
But the women are an economic of no value, meaning they can't bring money in, and they cost the father in the dowry. So they you're exactly right. They are not a help. into the family.
Plus in the population aim of one child per right. couple, you know, many, many of the daughters were actually sacrificed because you, since you could only have one baby, one child, you wanted to have a boy because that was your safety for old age. So, of course, all the...
In the countryside now, they're beginning to say we'll allow two.
Actually, it's not very well known, but that's pretty much always been this case there. The one child per family has been something that has pretty much been strictly adhered to in the urban areas.
Right.
And the countryside has never been required to do that.
Unless,
but the government didn't want the urban people right. to know that.
Right. Uh-huh. Or unless you've got some government official who's yeah. getting paid by somebody yeah. else to right. enforce it, that he gets more money.
You know, what
thank you, everybody.